Hello, my name is Brad McIntyre, and you're listening to the Cultivated Playwright Podcast, episode number 19. I'm sitting down to record this particular podcast on April 23rd, 2020. As some of you might be aware, April 23rd is considered Shakespeare Day. This is the day in 1616, April 23rd, when Shakespeare passed on. It is also rumored that he was born on the 23rd, back in 1564. We don't know for sure that he was born on that day, but he was definitely baptized. We have records of that on the 26th of April. And as was tradition at the time, parents would wait two or three days after a child was born to take them for their baptism. So popular rumor is it that Shakespeare was born the 23rd and died on the 23rd of April, which is poetic for one of our greatest of all poets. Anyway, over the last several years, I have been doing a great deal of reading about the life and career of William Shakespeare. I've gotten maybe half a dozen books on the life of Shakespeare, and my reading has mostly been general. It has been a generalized study in my quieter moments when I'm not entrenched in a thousand other things to do. I have been slowly reading about the life and times of William Shakespeare, but over the course of my reading, my focus has narrowed. Basically, it's centered on what I can take from William Shakespeare's life and career and apply it to my own creative life and my own career in the theater. Some of it carries over and some of it doesn't carry over, but that's what I have been focusing on in my reading over the last, maybe 2.5 years. Let's get a little bio out of the way. I'm pretty sure if you're listening to a podcast called The Cultivated Playwright, you're somewhat familiar with William Shakespeare. But if you're not, and you've stumbled on this somehow, here's a really, really, really quick synopsis of who William Shakespeare is, because we're going to be talking about him. So first of all, William Shakespeare is considered one of the greatest writers in the English language. But in reality, he was a lot more than that. He's born in a tiny little town called Stratford in Warwick, England. It was nestled on the River Avon, so it's usually called Stratford-upon-Avon. Avon pronounced the same way as the cosmetics line nowadays. He started writing professionally in his early 20s, and his career barely spanned a quarter of a century. He died at the age of 52 in April 1616, as I said before. Between about 1588 and 1613, so the tail end of the 1500s and the beginning of the 1600s, Shakespeare wrote at least 37 plays, and he collaborated on several more. He also turned out several major poems and over 150 sonnets, but beyond his writing life, which admittedly is considerable, Shakespeare was also a very well-known actor in his own lifetime. And he engaged in speculations and investments. By 1592, Shakespeare was well known enough as a writer and actor in London that he was criticized by a jealous rival named Robert Greene. He was called an upstart crow and a Johannes Factorum, which at the time meant Johnny Do-It-All, which apparently was a slam, in Robert Greene's pamphlet, Groat's Worth of Wit. A groat, by the way, is like a small coin from Elizabethan England. During his lifetime, Shakespeare's plays were already being performed abroad, as well as all over Britain, and even at sea off the coast of West Africa. His works have been translated into every known language on the planet, including some made-up ones, and acted all over the world. His influence is immeasurable. It is off the charts. The dude has had more impact and more far-reaching impact that can be easily stated. Now, after reading about William Shakespeare and his many activities, and I'm not going to get into the content of his plays, which are awesome, but he has a particular style of writing, and he focuses on different kinds of characters. I mentioned him in an earlier podcast a little bit when I talked about the history of comedy. He made huge innovations in the art of comedy and how comedies were written, bridging the gap from Roman comedies into a more modern sensibility, and he did a bunch of innovative things. I'm going to leave that aside. In fact, some of the things that I read about in Shakespeare's time don't carry over. One of those lessons that didn't translate well was that Shakespeare was writing at a time and in a place that predated radio, movies, television, and of course the internet. He was writing for Elizabethan London audiences. It was Elizabethan time period because Queen Elizabeth was the queen, and he was writing for audiences that were literally hungry for plays, for stories to be acted out on the stage. England kind of got in the swing of the Renaissance later than continental Europe. You got to remember in your mind, Shakespeare was born a full generation after Leonardo da Vinci and the height of the Italian Renaissance. Basically, Leonardo da Vinci was at the beginning of the 1500s. Shakespeare was at the end of the 1500s and early 1600s. In fact, unrelated to this podcast, just as a side note, I have recently also read a book called The Age of Genius by a guy named A.C. Grayling. And it argues that the 1600s, so Shakespeare kind of rang in the 1600s, is the birth of the modern mind. It is the century, the 100 years of the 1600s, that 17th century, when thinking went from a very supernatural and medieval ways of thinking and bridged the way into the Enlightenment and our more modern concepts of how humans live on this earth. Anyway, it's a fascinating book. It's called The Age of Genius, and maybe I'll do a podcast on that. I don't know. But the guy cites Shakespeare quite a bit in that book as heralding in the beginning of this century that changed the ways we think about the world. Anyway, James Burbage, the father of Richard Burbage, a colleague of William Shakespeare, built the first theater in England, in London, in the 1570s. That theater was called, aptly enough, The Theater. It was the first permanent, dedicated public theater built in England since Roman times. What I mean is, it was the first venue built to put on professionally produced plays for general audiences. Before this, before the theater, quote-unquote, opened, theater in England was mostly made up of the remnants of late medieval drama. This meant the religious mystery plays, you know, those plays that enacted scenes from the Bible, or their slightly more abstract counterparts, the morality plays. These were allegories in which the protagonist is met by personifications of moral attributes, like like virtues and vices and things like that, or possibly even pastoral plays from nature. These are plays like about rural life and shepherds and things like that. Religious theater, though, began to fade in prominence after Protestantism replaced Catholicism in England, which happened just before Shakespeare showed up on the scene. Queen Elizabeth put a ban on religious plays. So there's this huge void that needs to be filled. The public wanted more plays, but there's not a backlog of old plays to pull from in the Elizabethan time period. So Shakespeare, and a bunch of other writers, by the way, were writing at a time when the hunger from the audience, the market demand for new plays, was so super strong. oh my gosh, people wanted plays, and there wasn't even enough to furnish all the demand. So Shakespeare basically just fell into a gold mine. He was the right guy at the right time in the right place. As a contemporary worker in the theater, I can assure you this situation is completely different nowadays. This is one part of Shakespeare's career that does not translate, or not in a specific way. There is not a hankering for theater, I can assure you. In the media landscape, stage plays are nowhere near the top of the heap. They haven't been for over 100 years, at least. And I can't think of a single place on Earth anywhere in the year 2020 where people are literally clamoring for works on the stage. Theater, at best, is a quaint side art form. It is a training ground for the minds of writers and producers and actors who go on to make a lot more money in other mediums like television and film. And I say this with all clear practicality as a worker in the theater. That's how the theater is nowadays. There is an audience, but it is a small audience. They are an enthusiastic audience, theater goers nowadays, but there are few of them. And there's way more theater than there is to go around. So much more supply than demand on the stages of planet Earth in the year 2020. Anyway, the more I thought about the lessons that Shakespeare had to offer to contemporary performers and playwrights and such, the more a kind of out there notion began to creep into my mind. And there's one contemporary artist in the public light that seems to sort of parallel a lot of the career challenges, the habits, and the appeal that Shakespeare had. And that person is, of course, Dwayne The Rock Johnson. So, quick recap, because I'm pretty sure you know Dwayne The Rock Johnson if you live in the year 2020 and at period. Basically, if you live in 2020, you know who Dwayne The Rock Johnson is. Dwayne Johnson is an ex-college football player turned ex-WWE wrestler. In fact, he was one of the most popular wrestlers of all time who turned into a movie star. In fact, he is a movie star in a time when movie stars no longer exist. Since the turn of the last millennium, the old way of movie stars carrying movies, that's a bygone thing. That's a thing that faded off the radar 15 or 20 years ago. Dwayne Johnson, though, is a throwback in a way, because he is able to sell a movie because he is in it. And we're going to discuss his movies here in a second. He's probably one of the highest grossing box office stars of all time. He's a best-selling author. He's a television producer. He's basically a pop culture phenomenon. So, in this podcast, let's look at how these two entertainers, separated by 400 years and from completely different cultures, are actually very kindred spirits. So, first things first, let's talk about popularity. There's one sort of parallel to the way Elizabethan audiences used to clamor for new works for the theater, and that is the way contemporary audiences today clamor for franchise movies, or they want to binge watch streamed television shows. I say this very aptly, since we are all in quarantine, and I imagine we have gone through countless series of television shows as we've binge watched whatever we can on Netflix and Hulu and Amazon Prime and so on and so forth. Well, guess what? Dwayne The Rock Johnson makes both of these things, television shows and movies, in particular franchise movies. He has a couple of very profitable franchises under his belt. Up until recently, he was a lead reoccurring character on the HBO show Ballers, which he also co-produced. That series wrapped up just at the end of last year. But he makes pretty much nothing but big budget action movies that premiere at the cinemas. The two franchises he's part of, Jumanji and the Fast and the Furious films are both huge franchises and kind of rarities nowadays, by the way, and is that in that they are not superhero franchises. So what could be a criticism that Johnson releases movies that pretty much pander to a sensation-hungry crowd is really just simple economics. Johnson doesn't pretend to make art house cinema. Dwayne The Rock Johnson wants to make movies that appeal to the broadest possible audience. He proudly stands behind movies like Jumanji and Skyscraper and the Fast and the Furious films, that these films are built to play to the widest possible demographic, at which is to say, everyone, should not be looked down upon. Appealing to the masses has a long, long tradition. It should be noted, despite the fact that inexperienced high school kids and sometimes less intelligent adults still believe Shakespeare wrote quote-unquote high art, the opposite is much, much more accurate. Shakespeare wrote plays to sell tickets. He pandered to his audiences. He needed people, the commoners who bought the tickets, and the aristocracy who supported his company to like his plays. Here's the thing you don't hear a lot about. You don't hear of Dwayne Johnson picking fights with studio execs. Dwayne Johnson is universally thought of as a good collaborator and a nice guy. Maybe he's had a beef or two with the odd co-star or two, and I'm looking at you, Vin Diesel. But we never hear about him biting the hand that feeds him, so to speak. He doesn't have artistic differences, quote-unquote, with the studio bosses or his directors or co-producers and so on. In fact, one of Dwayne Johnson's defining attributes is his kind of charm and his a way of smoothing over and negotiating what he needs. And this not biting the hand that feeds you thing is not always the case in today's Hollywood / Twitterverse. Yeah, I'm looking at you, Josh Trank. It should be noted, Shakespeare also, quote-unquote, played the game. As I said earlier, Shakespeare was writing during the reign of Elizabeth I. She was the last monarch of the House of Tudor, and his history plays, for example, are often regarded as Tudor propaganda because they show the dangers of civil war and celebrate the founders of, guess what? That's right, the Tudor dynasty. He wasn't just not biting the hand that feeds him. He was celebrating that hand. He's holding that hand up to the golden light. And it should be noted, since we mentioned Dwayne The Rock Johnson's franchises, that Shakespeare also delved into franchise work. His Henry IV Part 1 and 2, as well as Henry V, can be considered sort of a franchise, if you will, about the two Henrys. In fact, if you can kind of trace the lineage of his the kings and queens of older English history as a long franchise, if you kind of open your mind to it. The other thing that Dwayne The Rock Johnson and Shakespeare have in common is an unparalleled work ethic. If you ever visit Dwayne Johnson's Instagram account, you can see that he not only gets up and works out at an ungodly hour in the morning, but in the last year or so, he has started traveling with his entire gym. He affectionately calls it the Iron Paradise. It's this huge setup of all these weight machines. His schedule is super jam-packed, and he keeps at it like a machine. He has assistants and things that help him. They prepare his meals and keep him on schedule. But Dwayne The Rock Johnson does the work. He's under no illusion that one of his major draws is his very, very muscled physique. And he works at it. In fact, Dwayne Johnson is his own product. His body, as well as his persona and his brand, they're his greatest creation. The dude has built himself into being Dwayne The Rock Johnson. And he knows he must invest time and energy in lifting ridiculous amounts of iron over and over again to keep this creation not just moving, but advancing. This is maintenance, but in a way, this is Johnson's work. Hitting the gym day after day is his bread and butter. It is what enables all the rest of Dwayne The Rock Johnson's appeal to happen. Dwayne The Rock Johnson is bigger than life. And because he is his own product, he has to invest a lot of time and energy into that product. Now, I want to read this passage from one of the books that I read over the last couple of years. It's James Shapiro's very excellent book, 1599, A Year in the Life of William Shakespeare. And in this passage, he writes about when Shakespeare actually had time during the day to write his plays. Because remember, we know Shakespeare as a playwright. That's where his legacy comes from. And the time and energy to write the plays had to be squeezed in around the day-to-day business of running a bunch of stuff. Here's the passage. As a resident playwright as well as actor in The Chamberlain's Men, a playing company that performed nearly year-round, most of Shakespeare's mornings were taken up with rehearsals, his afternoons with performances, and many of his evenings with company business, such as listening to freelance dramatists pitch new plays to add to the repertory. He had precious few hours, late at night and early in the morning, free to read and to write, often by flickering candlelight and fighting fatigue. So, The Rock, like Shakespeare, steals time deep in the morning hours to forge his creation. Now let's talk about the artist as an entrepreneur. So Shakespeare wasn't only a playwright. Beyond his writing life, which was considerable, Shakespeare was well known as an actor in his own lifetime. And even beyond this, he engaged in speculations and investments. He was a landowner and a money lender. He was also, and this is super important, a shareholder in his company, the Lord Chamberlain's Men. Later, they came under the sponsorship of King James after Queen Elizabeth passed on, and the company became the King's Men. So Shakespeare was a businessman. In the movie All Is True, which came out last year, Kenneth Branagh plays Shakespeare at the end of his life as he returns to Stratford and to a quiet retirement after a career of 25 years in the theater in London. And one rich, entitled, and rather super annoying neighbor keeps pressing him. And he looks down on Shakespeare's career in London as a theater maker. And Branagh's Shakespeare answers the man in one of the most excellent monologues of the movie.
Well, well, Mr. Shakespeare. How very unfortunate. Seems your daughter's wedding was rushed for a reason. Like your own, eh? The apple doesn't fall far from the tree. Damn me, you Shakespeares are a scandalous lot. Perhaps being an illiterate farm girl, your wife was unable to teach your girls morals. Well, well, must be getting on. Can't loll about all day thinking pretty thoughts like you poets. I must do business.
Business, Sir Thomas?
Yes, business. A large estate like Charlecote doesn't run itself, you know.
Oh, I thought you meant real business. Like building, owning, and operating London's largest theatre, for instance. Actors, carpenters, seamstresses, crew to pay, bribes to pay, security to mount, politics to navigate, 3,000 paying customers to be fed and watered every afternoon, each promised a spectacle greater than the last, 170 royal command performances for our Queen and our King. Have you ever considered the logistics of mounting the Battle of Shrewsbury in the banqueting hall at Hampton Court? Please don't, it would make you so tired. And yet in all the years that I have run my vast, complex and spectacularly successful business, Thomas, I have indeed found the time to think and to write down the pretty thoughts you mention and which in my experience bring immense pleasure to those who seek mere diversion or respite from this veil of tears, without which it would all be about as pointless as... well, about as pointless as you, Sir Thomas. And since you mention her, my wife, Anne, has more decency and wisdom in her daily shit than you have in your entire body. Oh, and I wish I had poached your bloody deer.
Anyway, as you can see, Shakespeare was in charge of a lot of things, and in this way, too, he shares a lot with his future counterpart, Dwayne The Rock Johnson. It should be pointed out, Dwayne The Rock Johnson is a brand representative for Under Armour Athletic Wear. His production company, 7 Bucks, is a small media empire, developing television reality shows like The Titan Games and Rock and a Hard Place. They develop podcasts and digital media. I mean, Dwayne Johnson has his own line of tequila. So he's not just a movie actor. He is an entrepreneur. He is a businessman as well. So the two men also share that in common. They have other parallels, both large and small, but these three main things, their popularity, their entrepreneurship, and their work ethic, that kind of tie them together. I don't know if we're going to be talking about Dwayne The Rock Johnson and his work, in particular his work, 400 years from now. In fact, I can't think of hardly any contemporary artists who stand a chance of being celebrated and enjoyed, so to speak, 400 years from now. That's one of the reasons Shakespeare stands out to me. That the guy wrote 400 plus years ago. His plays are produced, they're being produced around the planet somewhere today, probably. I mean, the planet's in shutdown at the moment, but his plays are put on more than any other playwright, living or dead, that has ever existed on the planet. That's a legacy. I mean, that's staying power. There's something in his work that appeals to people and has appealed to people for centuries. I can't think of other contemporary artists who have that sort of appeal. Like the people that are living in my lifetime, and I will include Dwayne The Rock Johnson in this, but I would love if Dwayne The Rock Johnson somehow makes an impact on the culture big enough to not just be a footnote 400 years from now, in that he doesn't create his own work but interprets it, is a little bit of a drawback for poor Dwayne The Rock Johnson. But I do think these are kindred spirits. These guys who seem nothing alike. One is a muscle-bound, highly charismatic movie actor who engages in a bunch of other business activities. And the other one is a poet and playwright who lived in England during the reign of Queen Elizabeth at the fading days of the Renaissance. But still, there's a legacy there, and the legacy has been passed down, and I believe The Rock is not the embodiment nowadays of Shakespeare, but at least some parts of Shakespeare. The ethos of what Shakespeare was doing in his career and in his own lifetime sort of live on in how The Rock touches on our culture today. Anyway, hey, thanks for listening. I'm going to wrap it up. It's good to be back. Hopefully, I'll get around to making a couple of more of these podcasts over the next couple of weeks before I disappear into the ether again. But hey, guess what? These things aren't going anywhere. All the backlog of episodes are available on the website. Feel free to look them up anytime you want. Take a listen to the older episodes. And you can check me out at my website, bradmcintyre.com. There's links to all my other social media sites there. You can take a look at some of my work. There's links to my books available on Amazon and so forth and so on. And hey, thanks for listening.
The Rock just wants to know, what is your name? It doesn't matter what your name is!